Good. So I'm Rick Hansen. This is July 23rd, 2014. And last week I talked about practicing with a heavy heart because my heart was pretty heavy last week. It was not looking good for our family's cat. And yesterday actually was the last day of his very good and very long life. So my heart is still fairly heavy, and so be it, right? If there's anything Buddhism teaches, is impermanence of all kinds. And also what happened last week is because of my mindlessness, I think I positioned my microphone for this recording so that it kept brushing against my shirt. So the first 25 minutes was fairly staticky. Got a few emails to that effect. And so I'll try to do a better job this time, and we'll try to get our technology right. So I thought I would do a little bit of a recap, but especially focus one of the three great ways to practice, including with a heavy heart, which is to say, letting be, and explore in that context of just simply letting our experience be, feeling our feelings, experiencing the experience, being present with it. Relate that to one of the major obstructions to simply opening to experience and being with it, which is to say, the fear of risking a dreaded experience. And that fear of risking the dreaded experience tends to really imprison us in a cage of our own making that may have made sense many years ago, but today keeps us trapped. And I want to also explore what are, in my view, genuinely delusional aspects that are well-intended, as we'll see, in terms of biological evolution, but still even though these well-intended delusional aspects of the whole structure of this kept our ancestors alive, and we're here today as a result, thank you for their delusions, right? It creates a lot of needless suffering today that we can see through, especially that we're no longer, most of us at least, fearing for our lives on a daily basis. Okay, so to this material, everybody has a heavy heart sometime. And some people have a heavy heart a lot of the time. I mean, you can imagine some of the things going on in the world that hit the headlines, and then you can just imagine the lives of all kinds of people who don't hit the headlines. Children, adults, people worried about others, people grappling with chronic pain, depression, all the rest of that. Loss of a beloved pet. Heavy hearts. Part of life. Okay. How can we practice with it? So last week I talked about three ways to engage the mind, in my view. I think there's a fourth way, which is where we transcend the mind altogether, but that kind of starts edging out of the so-called natural frame. I'll stay inside the natural frame right here, mainly, if not entirely, and talk about letting be, letting go, and letting in. So we have a choice. If something comes up, let's say the heart is heavy. We're sad about something, we're very moved, we're feeling a lot. First, we can simply be with it. Feel the feelings, experience the experience, not resist it, open to it, unpack it. The Buddha used a lot the language of disentangle. You know, experience being kind of like a tapestry or a fabric, a cloth, easing the threads apart, opening it up. And we can also investigate. Of the seven factors of awakening, one of them is investigation, sometimes considered to be the most important of the seven because it tends to lead to the others. So we can explore what's softer, what's younger, what's more fundamental, what's more elemental, more primary. But we're not trying to change the experience. It may change in its own right, kind of like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle applied to our own experience, that observing things can make them change. But we're not directly making efforts with our mind to change what we're experiencing, including perhaps a heavy heart. Okay? The second way to practice is around releasing, letting go, where we do various things. We let the tension come out of the body. We say goodbye, including to loved ones. We let our feelings flow, we let the tears flow. We challenge thoughts that seem wrong or false or problematic or incomplete. Let them go. We release unwholesome desires, you know, of any kind, eating too much, drinking too much, or restraining ourselves too much, or clinging to any living being whose time has come to pass along. And then, of course, there's a third way to practice, where we practice bhavana in Sanskrit, cultivation, where we are growing resources, wholesome factors, compassion, mindfulness, loving kindness, resilience, forgiveness, insight, tranquility, concentration, bliss is a factor, all the rest. You know, you've probably heard my metaphor, if the mind is like a garden, the mind-brain system, we can simply witness it, letting be. We can pull weeds, letting go, or we can plant flowers, letting in. So that's a kind of structure. And last week, if you'd had the hearing of Superwoman or Superman, you would have been able to catch every word, but we explored different ways to do that, including with regard to letting be. I used the Buddhist model of the five aggregates, the five aspects of reality and phenomenology, materiality out there in our experiencing, as it were, in here. Those five aspects being form, which is all of material reality plus our bare apprehension of it, and then the feeling tone, the hedonic tone of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or a blend. Perception, the third aggregate. Memory or categorization, this is bread, this is a banana, this is a tree. This is my hand, this is the banana, that's perception. And then the so-called volitional formations, the fourth aggregate in the Buddha's system, pretty much all other thoughts, emotions, desires, plans, enneagram points, object relations from childhood, et cetera, et cetera, and then awareness itself. Those are the five. So that's a nice way to explore experience and to let it be. Okay? So in terms now of what I have said as my main topic, risking the dreaded experience, in order to tolerate letting be, we have to be able to bear our own experience. And if we're not resourced inside, opening to experience can be like opening a trapdoor to hell. Right? So naturally, there's a tendency to ward off certain kinds of experiences. It's been said that in psychology, there are probably two major factors that account for the greater portion of all mental health issues, all psychopathology, quote unquote. And those two factors are, and you might ask yourself how you are with regard to them. Number one, rumination. Chewing, you know, the word rumination comes from cows chewing their cud. They are ruminants, okay? Because they eat grass and it needs to go through some number of stomachs, I think four or something like that. So they're chewing it, right? We chew on this stuff. Anxious rumination, resentful rumination, self-critical rumination. You know, Sokni Rinpoche says, think the same thought 10 times, fine, but that's enough. Right? You know, that's rumination. So you might want to ask yourself, you know, are you thinking about stuff and identified with the thinking rather than sort of standing back and watching it happen over there? But, you know, it's one thing to watch the hamster wheel going like, wow, I sure obsess about stuff, weird, versus being in the hamster wheel, wing, 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 wing. You know, you might ask yourself about that. The other major factor, which is really specific to my topic tonight, is low distress tolerance, poor distress tolerance, poor capacity to tolerate experience. So then people do things that are short-term solutions to the problem of unpleasant experiences, but become long-term problems themselves, like self-medicating with alcohol or repressing feelings. As I've joked, you know, the mind is not like a flush toilet. It's more like a septic tank. That stuff sticks around, all right? Okay, so just pushing it down comes back eventually. As Freud called it, the return of the repressed. So that's not so good, right? So cultivating distress tolerance, kind of an inner shock absorber, if you will, is a key factor in our ability to let be or to be with our experience, to feel our feelings, and to hold them in spacious awareness. Okay. So how do we grow distress tolerance? How do we grow the capacity to, as Pema Chodron puts it, bear our own experience? When, as she also says, when things fall apart. Or as Jon Kabat-Zinn titled, I think his second book, Full Catastrophe Living. How do you live with the full catastrophe? And we're talking the full Megillah, way beyond the death of a loved cat. How do you live with that? So I want to now talk about what's been for me a very general and a very useful model in psychology, and then relate it to this notion of delusion, well-intended delusions. So if you can look at your own experience, let's say it's a relationship, okay, where there's something in you to communicate, but you're holding back. Or maybe think about your career or your creative life altogether. Maybe there's some project or book or poem or garden or tree or painting, what have you. But each day you kind of put it off. There's something about it. There's an avoidance of it. Okay. Or think about some thing you do to get through the day. You know, that third cookie? I also had a guru for a while. He said, one, that's a philosopher. Two, a pervert. Anyway, so one, you know, there's a place for moderation, right? You know, one is enough, but maybe not 17. What's the third? Yeah, right. That's right. That's right. That's right. I was going to say that's you, but that would be really bad. But anyway, I'm joking. Okay, so my point is, you know, in other words, what would you feel if you didn't do that thing, right? If you, I have a little habit, I type a lot and I can feel the skin, the callous skin between my fingernail, and I have a tendency to pick it away because I feel it. And what would I do if I didn't do that? What would you do if you didn't bite your nails? What would you do if you didn't have that third glass of wine, right? See what I mean? What would you do if instead of ruminating, because rumination is a defense against feeling, aha, looping, wing, wing, cognitively, thought, is a great way to avoid feeling. And very often, if people just relax and open to the feeling that they're keeping at bay through ruminating, the rumination kind of grounds out in short circuits. That's a very interesting thing to know. Okay, so you might want to ask yourself, so here's the structure. Three, it's like a lap around a track, except it's like a triangle. It's like a triangle track, okay? The first leg of the track in the flow of experience, which often goes down in less than a few seconds, even less than a second or two. The first track is there's some natural expression of the self, the being altogether. Some speaking from the heart, some assertiveness, some want, some seeing of the way it is, some project, right? Some assertiveness in a relationship. There's some expression. Or it could simply be there's some experience there, okay? Then in the second leg of the track, there is the fear of what you'd experience if you did that thing, if you unleashed that expression of self. What would you feel if you spoke up in that business meeting and they laughed at you? What would you feel if you asked someone to love you and their eyes kind of glazed over and they started looking elsewhere, right? Think about what we risk, right? What would you feel if you didn't anesthetize yourself, what have you, in that way, right? So there's the natural expression. Then there's what do we expect? And we form these expectations a lot in childhood based on what's happened to us. This is what happens when you challenge an authority figure. Whoa, you know, this is what happens when you're sexual. Whoa. This is what happens when other people are allowed to be sexual with you. Whoa. This is what happens when you try to join a group and they push you out in eighth grade. All right? So we form these expectations of what we'd experience based on either experiencing it. You know, when I express myself in this authentic way, or I open in this way, you know, I either feel bad in this, you know, like this, or I watch other people feeling bad. If other people speak up to authority, other people ask for love, other people are firm, other people are soft and vulnerable and open and revealed, what the heck? Whatever it is, I see bad things happen to them, or third, I imagine that they will. Okay? So we have what's really going on here. Then there's the fear of what would I'd feel, I'd experience, if I really go there. And then third leg of the triangular track is the defense against the experience. The repression, the intellectualization, the joke, the subtle distancing. You know, what would I feel if I got, you know, close to someone? And then there's that subtle distancing away. Or what would I feel if they got too close to me? And then there's that subtle distancing away, you see? Or what if I just push that whole thing out of awareness as fast as I can? See the structure of this? And it happens really fast. We've got a brain that, you know, is firing 5 to 50 times a second. The neural substrates of working memory, RAM and the neural computer, are updating around every 6 seconds. Pardon me, say about 6 times a second. You know, that's pretty fast. Okay. A lot of stuff can happen in a second or two. As we know from observing our own mind, you know, you can kind of pretty easily be aware of at least one or two kind of discrete mind moments per second, if not 3 or 4 or more. So you see the structure of it, right? So to be able to stay with a heavy heart, we have to be able to tolerate what we fear might happen, you know, if we really feel it. Now, what I've observed, this is the delusion part, and then I want to see what you think about this, especially applied to three kinds of things. If you look closely, what we fear we'd experience, the dreaded experience, okay, is almost never as bad as we anticipate it to be. It's uncomfortable. If you ask for love and they don't give you love, you know, if you speak up and it doesn't go well, if you, you know, try to speak publicly and doesn't turn out well, whatever. You know, it's not the most comfortable thing in the world. You know, you go on Match.com and you say, what the heck? I'm going to throw my hat in the ring yet again. You know, give it a whirl. And, you know, you go out on the date and you really like him and, yeah, the feeling's not very mutual. You feel bad. There's some kind of bad feeling. But if you look closely at it, it's almost never as bad as it was billed to be. Why is that? Why is that? I think it's that case, in other words, there's a discrepancy between the expected experience, the affective forecasting, right, that we use to govern our behavior. We're continually forming expectations of what it would be like for us if. What will it be like for us if we go have Chinese food? What will it be like for us if we stay home? What would it be like for us if we, you know, decide to skip dinner tonight in solidarity with the hungry people around the world, whatever, right? What would it be like for us if we go out and have a great time, spend a lot of money, get kind of hammered, and then wake up the next morning? What would that be like, right? We do that all the time, you know, in ways large and small, often small. Like, how would it go if I do this conversation with that person at work like this versus that? How should I say it, right? We do that all the time, okay? So we're constantly anticipating. That's what's called affective forecasting. We're predicting. The brain is a big prediction machine. Okay? Why are our predictions usually tilted negatively? You know, in this regard. There are two reasons. One reason is that these predictions are generated by relatively ancient subcortical systems, the amygdala, the hippocampus, etc., that evolved with basically the late reptiles and first mammals, which is to say around 200 million years ago. So this little module that's, you know, basically arose with the late iguanas and the early rats is predicting how it will feel for you if you speak up at work. Right? And those ancient systems are very primitive. You know, they're very intense. It's kind of like really good or really bad. Right? So that's one thing, and that's really interesting to observe. Just again, and you can just see it kind of casually. There you are, you're sort of imagining how it will be for you if you hang out with your friends, or you get together with somebody else, or you stay home and watch TV, and there's this anticipated reward. And then notice how kind of inflated that anticipated reward is compared to what you actually experience. That's a kind of well-intended auto-delusion. The other thing is that the second main reason for this well-intended delusion is that from the standpoint of survival, the biological machinery of evolution is, it's not like there's some master programmer who's trying to figure it all out, trying to optimize things. You know, it's very simplistic. It's kind of based on bottom line, what works? What frankly increases the odds of passing on genes that pass on genes, accumulated over thousands of generations? Right. So in that context, if we want to keep monkeys, let's say, from risking some kind of social aggression inside their band or between bands, and what keeps monkeys alive is really avoiding anything that might be risky. It makes sense to exaggerate the risks because it's really direct. If we exaggerate the risks, you won't go there. You'll be depressed, you'll be miserable, you'll be one inhibited monkey, but you'll live to see the sunrise and pass on genes that pass on genes. So there's no cost in exaggerating the consequences. And ancient critters who had genes that led them, their brains, to exaggerate consequences got gains from that in terms of the odds of passing on genes that passed on genes, and they didn't pay much of a price. Maybe they were kind of excessively anxious. You know, the neural architecture of primal emotions, fear, rage, and lust, are present basically in the brainstem structures of a well-developed reptile like a crocodile. Certainly within a rat or a cat. So you see it so far? And it's kind of wild to appreciate the utterly impersonal, ancient, and enormously biological, powerful, and hardwired basis of this kind of delusional resistance to risking the dreaded experience. And normally, if you think about the Buddha's three poisons, so-called, he originally talked about them as the three fuels for the fires of craving and suffering. Later on in Tibet, they talked about them as poisons, either way. Okay? Greed, hatred, delusion. Personally, I think there's a fourth poison or fourth fuel, heartache, having to do with our social issues that can't just be deconstructed into merely greed or merely hatred. Separate issue. A lot I've understood, as other people have, delusion as ignorance. Confusion. Delusion's a pretty intense word, right? Now, I think there is a place for ignorance, just not recognizing the transience of experience. You know, not recognizing its compounded dependent arising and passing away. Okay, ignorance is a part of it. But I think also there's a frank delusion. When we have a mind-brain system that automatically, routinely exaggerates the risks of speaking from the heart, or other forms of full self-expression, or just opening to our feelings as adults today, that's a kind of delusion. And I think it's actually useful to use that word internally, not in a self-shaming way, but in a really hopeful way. Because when, you know, like a little kid wakes up and goes, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, there's a Darth Vader's under the bed, Darth Vader's under the bed. And you know, sweetie, that was a nightmare. It seemed real, but that was a dream. Waking up from the enchantment. It's good news to wake up from the delusion. And if we can, as I wrap up here, regard these delusions that limit us from risking the dreaded experience, you know, if we can regard them as impersonal and delusional and afflictive, we're going to be more willing to risk the dreaded experience. And then when we risk the dreaded experience, you know, the smart way to do it, by the way, is in graduated ways, kind of working your way up the ladder. 0 to 10 scales, 10 rungs on the ladder. Start at 1, Don't just walk into your boss's office and go, "You, I wanted to talk to you for, you know." That may be an 8 or a 10. You know, careful. So work your way up. Okay. But as you risk the dreaded experience and it goes well, which it usually does, when it goes well, set yourself up to win. So set yourself up to succeed. Truly. Be on your own side. Be a friend to yourself. When you risk the dreaded experience and it does go well, really take in the good. Really internalize that. So you become increasingly free of that particular constraint on your full self-expression, and the invisible bars of your cage move out at least one big step. And then step and step and step, you become freer and freer and freer. Okay. So you might think about this as it's applied perhaps in relationships. In what ways do you feel bound? Think about anything that's chronically sticky or problematic in a current relationship, or something that's been a long-standing issue for you in relationships. And then ask yourself, how could this structure of I'm avoiding risking the dreaded experience apply in that relationship? And as I bring more insight to it, including seeing through the delusional, exaggerated, amplified nature of these anticipated pains, anticipated unpleasantnesses, as I do that, I can become increasingly free and skillful in this relationship, for example. Okay. And you can also apply this, as I said, to self-expression in the form of creative pursuits or ambitions, aspirations in life or business. And you can also apply it to things you do to just keep experiences at bay of all kinds, including retail therapy. Okay. Comments or questions so far? And because it's been a long week for my wife and me, I'll end very close to 8:30. Okay. Yeah.
So, Rick, could you say more about the delusion of the dreaded experience in a relationship where you are trying to maybe protect something fragile that's in the other? Something that you sense deeply is very vulnerable in them.
Yeah. So thank you for that. So there's a place, obviously, for rational, reasonable, you know, good bets, placing good bets about trying to prevent harms or to navigate tricky situations, tricky relationships, right? There's a place for that, including protecting other people. I was actually with a father and his young adult daughter earlier today, and a lot of things that happened in that relationship, and a lot of it boiled down to he underestimated how much he mattered to her. And so his actions of various kinds had a lot of impact on her. His intent wasn't bad, but his impact was pretty harmful, definitely painful. So there's a place for that, on the one hand. Second, the key here is that word experience. Often the way we formulate it in our mind is I want to avoid the dreaded event. But the events don't matter. Circumstances don't matter. What matters is our experience of circumstances. That's what we care about. Right? It's not so much that I don't want to risk the dreaded event of losing the banana. It's that I want to avoid risking the dreaded experience of hunger, breakdown in the body, weakness, fear. That's what I want to avoid. See, so, okay? Try to bring it down to your experience. What's the experience that I'm dreading, that I'm trying to avoid risking? And when you go to experience, you know, there's a lot more freedom. Because fairly quickly you get to fast. What are the odds of that experience? These are three great questions to help yourself. If you think about it, a lot of this learning was in early childhood. So in early childhood, the dreaded experience happened a lot. Right? You were stuck in that school, stuck in that, you know, you had that kid in eighth grade, made your life hell. You're in that family situation. Your parents had to move constantly, whatever it was. You grew up in that larger environment. It happened a lot. Two, when it happened, it was really intense because children have much less neurological maturation of systems that calm and soothe their emotional reactions, particularly negative emotional reactions. That's a great way to keep four-year-olds alive in the Serengeti, okay? But it does create a lot of intensity in the way in which experiences land. And third, after it happened often and felt horrible, the kids' coping capabilities were really pretty minimal. To understand it, to make sense of it, to put it in context, to get away, to do various things that adults can do. But so you see those three? And one way to help yourself risk the dread experience, you know, in addition to this kind of seeing the delusional amplification of the anticipated pain, is to ask yourself, what are the odds really of this experience? What are the odds of the events that I fear, and what are the odds of me having the experience that I dread, really? It might happen, but what are the odds of it? Okay, so if I, you know, speak up at work and I say something stupid, what are the odds of everybody doing to me what they did do in seventh grade? And I'll kind of laugh hysterically and decide I was a fool and stop inviting me to their parties, right? What are the odds of that really happening today at Hewlett-Packard or what have you? Second, if it did happen, how bad would the experience be? Would it really be on the 0 to 10 horribleness scale, a 7 or an 8 like it really was, you know, junior high, or when I was 4 years old or 6 months old? Would it really be that, you know, that intense? No, it wouldn't. It'd be a drag, but on the yuck scale, it'd be like a 3 or a 4. How long would it last? Would it just blow your mind for days at a time? No, it'd be a few hours probably, gradually fading, right? And then third, if it did happen, and it was intense, or could I cope with it? How could I cope with it in ways that I have today as an adult that I didn't have as a kid? I have credit cards. I have access to the shopping channel, right? I can call a friend. I can say, go to hell, and walk out of the room. There's a lot I can do. I can call my lawyer, you know? I can watch Oprah. There's a lot, right, I could do that I just couldn't do as a kid. I didn't have coping mechanisms like I have as an adult, right? Okay, so those are kind of useful, I think, those three. Okay, another comment or question? Did you, no? Yeah. Okay, but first you, Isaac.
I just have a quick one.
Thanks.
I realized that I had been to Donald Rothbard's meditation class, and I was complaining about my ex. And I realized, this is on Dharma Seed now. This is archived on Dharma Seed. And it hit me right in the beginning of the meditation. So I go, oh my God, it's going to get back to her, and then I'm going to get the call. But the odds of that, and then it's on your tape now. So it's like the NSA.
Hello, Dick Cheney.
Yeah. But what are the odds?
Yeah,
really,
that's right.
Who's going to click on a Dharma Seed? But she is a practicing Buddhist and in the community, so it's impossible. But it was funny because I went into absolute terror mode in the beginning of the meditation. And then I went, no, it's a 100-to-1 shot.
Well, thanks. That's a great example. And isn't that interesting, that terror mode, as you put it? You know, and if you can really track your experience, usually we notice this three-legged track, three-sided track, in the third leg of the track, where we're implementing the defense. You know, an hour later, a second later, a year later, we think, why did I do that? Why did I subtly distance from that person? Or why did I get into that kind of funny argument? Or why did I just get all sleepy right there? You know? And then we work backwards. So that's a good thing to do as well. It gets very powerful to do this in real time. There you are. Something's arising. The heart is opening. Some strength is coming forward. Something is happening. And then you can register the fears associated with it. And then the ways of suppressing it, right? Okay, great. So, but try to get more and more into real time with this. All right, one more person?
I'm just going to say one thing that's super helpful in our relationship that I've noticed, that if not only being your own friend if you're going to do the dreaded thing, but cue your partner. I'm about to do a dreaded thing for myself.
Right, that's
and
great.
And so one of us will be really soft where we could have missed it and been like, yeah, whatever. And it, again, you're really vulnerable, so it hits you badly. But the frame is like, okay, got it. Go ahead, you know, and you're ready for it. And the other thing that we do in our work that seems helpful for people, and I find it helpful for myself, is if the worst thing does happen, can I handle it? Is it worth it to me to do it according to my values? If I frame it in my values, it gives me the courage of a minor discomfort. It takes it to a different plane for me.
That's great. Beautiful advice. Yeah, it's great. Thank you. Yeah, maybe I'll end on this note that I think it's enormously helpful to practice around fear, including subtle fears, worries, anxieties, apprehensions, subtle things, as well as stronger fears, including a kind of, I think of it as sort of auto fear, this ongoing trickle of anxiety that's designed by Mother Nature to keep animals on their toes, but is actually delusional, because truly there's nothing to fear walking across this room, for example. And gradually getting to a point where, I think, how can I put it? I think in the mind, there are basically two major contents of awareness that are privileged, right? We have sounds, we have sights, we have thoughts, we have emotions, we have memories, we have sensations, the whole caboodle. The two that for me tend to grab the talking stick and jump to the pulpit and start, you know, directing things, fear and the sense of I. And often they go together. What am I going to do about that? They might hurt me. I might feel horrible. My ex might call Donald Rothberg and shame me. I'm just making that up. See what I mean? See what I mean? So those are two to really kind of watch. They may arise. Fear will arise. It's okay for fear to be present. Do we have to privilege it, though? Do we have to put it in charge? Or can we just go, ah, fear. Ah, delusional, dreaded, delusional dread. Okay? Okay, great. How about we just sit for a minute and wrap it up. What?
Thank you for being here tonight.
Oh, thank you. It's very healing, honestly.
How old was
your cutie? About 17, 18 years. Rescued, about 3 years old. Smartest cat I ever knew. I like cats a lot. Very intelligent, look you in the eyes, person. I would joke with my wife that our cat, whose name is Tsunami, was like a really intelligent four-year-old with no language. Very playful. Thank you. All right, let's sit. May all beings be truly at peace and happy. And I will now get out of the way.